Topic 6, spirituality and anxiety disorders. Panic disorder, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and general anxiety disorder. Let me begin this presentation by talking about anxiety in general, and specifically about my own experience with anxiety as a teenager. When I was 19 years old, I was traveling in a car. I was in the passenger seat, and a friend of mine, a contemporary, was driving the car. And as we were driving along, the driver, said, "I feel like I'm having a heart attack. I can't breathe." He started to clench his chest, to have very short, shallow breaths, to start to get very jittery and anxious. And of course, I had never witnessed anything like this previously. So I reached over and grabbed the steering wheel and brought the car over to the side. And when I was able to finally catch my own breath, he started to calm down a bit, but I was concerned enough to drive him at this point immediately to the emergency room. And by the time we got to the emergency room, about 10 minutes later, he was kind of calm, and we had an evaluation, and they tested his heart, and the conclusion was that my friend was experiencing a panic attack. That was a relief at the time, but certainly during those 10 minutes, especially of the panic attack in its active phase, there was no relief. It was terrifying for him and for me, who was a witness to this experience of extreme anxiety expressed this way. In general, anxiety disorders have a range of symptoms, from the dramatic panic attack that I just described to the more ordinary expression of anxiety as chronic worry. Anxiety, of course, is not inherently a bad thing. In fact, it's a good thing. Sigmund Freud, in his own language, called signal anxiety the appropriate and necessary alert to danger, whether psychological or physical danger, that was imminent. So that, for example, when we know that something bad is about to happen, we ought to feel anxious about it. Or, conversely, when we're trying something new, when we're engaging a new task or a project, there ought to be an appropriate amount of anxiety to motivate us. In fact, there's a law called the Yerkes-Dodson Law that suggests that we need a moderate amount of anxiety for our best performance. If we engage a task with absolutely no anxiety, we're likely to be lazy and complacent and not do it well enough. But conversely, if we have excessive worry and anxiety, we're likely to freeze up and not be able to perform well. I used to have some reluctance at the part of the Mass just before communion when the priest prays, "Free us from all anxiety," because psychologically speaking, that would be a very unsteady and unhealthy place for us to be. But I'm less concerned about that at this point and am happy to join in the prayer to be freed from all anxiety. I think most of us understand the intention of that prayer. Unnecessary maladaptive anxiety is the source of the disorders that we're considering right now: panic disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and generalized anxiety disorder. Allow me to take each of those disorders in turn and to isolate the essential components before we move on to psychological and spiritual interventions that may be very helpful in overcoming this anxiety. In the case of panic disorder, the essential feature is the presence of at least one panic attack, as I described earlier, that is unexpected. Sometimes they are cued. People have panic attacks when they see a snake or a vicious dog or a menacing cat or whatever the cue might be. But oftentimes, in fact, most frequently, panic attacks are unexpected, just as they came on in the example that I gave at the beginning. The panic attack has a sudden onset and builds to a peak rapidly, usually in 10 minutes or less, where there is sweating, trembling, nausea, chest pains, a fear of dying or of going crazy. And with recurrent attacks, panic attacks, there is a disruption in interpersonal relationships and a demoralization. Typically, the age of onset for panic disorder is late adolescence all the way to mid-30s. So there's a range there. And among all the anxiety disorders, panic disorder has the highest genetic contribution. So if you have a family member who has panic disorder, you're very likely also to have it. Biological relatives are 4 to 7 times more likely to have a panic disorder than non-relatives. Obsessive compulsive disorder is, as the name suggests, comprised of both obsessions, which are unwanted thoughts, and compulsions, which are unwanted behaviors. Obsessions, these intrusive, unwelcome thoughts, can consist of doubts. You know, did I lock the car as I walk away from it? Are the lights still on? Do I need to go back and check? They can also be more serious doubts and thoughts about a sense of sinfulness or contamination. Sometimes people feel that they are dirty, contaminated, impure, which sometimes in religious contexts will make people afraid to receive Holy Communion or will seek frequent confession. And by frequent, I mean daily or even sometimes several times a day because they feel so, a person can feel so pure, impure, and so contaminated. Or obsessions can be violent impulses, even toward people that I love and care about. And of course, these are unwanted. Now, these obsessions generate a great deal of anxiety, hence their categorization as an anxiety disorder. And so people engage in repetitive behaviors, compulsions, in an attempt to reduce that anxiety. So people engage in hand washing or counting. They have various rituals and need to count a certain amount of marbles or a certain amount of blocks or put things in certain order or do various checking rituals, etc. Again, to try to reduce that anxiety. Obsessive compulsive disorder causes marked distress. It can be very time consuming. People could spend an hour or more a day preoccupied with their obsessions and compulsions. And so naturally, this will interfere with normal functioning, both at home and at work and social activities. People who have obsessive compulsive disorder often avoid other people and situations that they might, for example, perceive as dirty or contaminated. So you might find a person who's very reluctant to handshake or doesn't want their hand to be touched or to touch another for fear of contamination. Substance abuse is also a frequent comorbid correlate of OCD, where people, again, will use substances to medicate the anxiety associated with that. The typical age of onset for obsessive compulsive disorder is adolescence, but it can begin as early as childhood. And thirdly, generalized anxiety disorder, where the essential feature is excessive anxiety and worry that is difficult to control. This may be less dramatic than panic disorder and obsessive compulsive disorder, but it is equally crippling and paralyzing because it's chronic. It can be accompanied by restlessness, fatigue, irritability, and sleep disturbance. And the content of the worry here is ordinary. It can be excessive worry about job, about health, about minor matters like car repairs or being on time. And again, as stated earlier, it's chronic. You know, every day I wake up worrying about something, and I can't stop worrying. Even people say when they go on vacation or go to the movies or take breaks from duties and responsibilities, still will these worries and fears will persist. This has been diagnosed as early as childhood. We have over-anxious children who worry about their competence and performance and, of course, grow into perfectionistic adults. Now, sometimes these disorders that I have described, these disorders of anxiety, respond very well to psychiatric treatment. And by that, I mean drugs like the whole class of selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Paxil, for example, or even to an older class of antidepressants like anafrenil has been used to treat OCD. But I'd like to focus here on the psychological treatments and then spiritual interventions. Psychologically, cognitive therapy has been very helpful to try to identify the cognitive distortions that underlie anxiety. For example, in the case of panic, I'm going to die. Or in the case of OCD, I'm dirty. Or in the case of generalized anxiety, I'm going to be late. And try to restructure those thoughts by decatastrophizing them. You know, what keeps the anxiety at its peak is that each of these thoughts is catastrophized, as if the world would end if I were late or if I'm dirty. And to try to teach the person through various cognitive methods that, you know, the danger is not as bad as I think it will be. There's a whole host of literature on what is called affective forecasting. That is, we as human beings are very poor at forecasting how we are going to feel when a certain event happens in our lives. And this happens with both good and bad events. We might think, for example, that if I lose that person, I will fall apart. I won't be able to function. And then we lose that person, and lo and behold, we do not decompensate as we anticipated. Conversely, we may think, when I get that job promotion, my life is going to be nirvana. I'm going to be completely happy. And what happens is we get the job promotion, and there are other things to distract us from being blissfully happy. So we don't forecast well, and this decatastrophizing is all about instructing people that the worst that you expect is very likely not to happen, first of all, and even if it were, it's not likely to cause you the distress that you expect that it will. Behaviorally, from a psychological perspective, we need to identify how avoidance only reinforces the problematic behavior by reducing the anxiety associated with it. So, for example, when people are afraid of anything, the intervention is to get them to actually engage it, what's called exposure. From a spiritual perspective, St. Ignatius, among others, used to talk about the Latin phrase agere contra, which means when you don't want to do something because you're afraid of it, you ought to do it. That's what exposure is all about. The natural cycle of anxiety is that as we anticipate something that we fear, our anxiety starts to ascend and it gets higher and higher, but then it reaches a peak and then starts to descend on its own. The problem becomes when we become afraid of ascending anxiety, and then that fear itself makes us more anxious, and we start to avoid the event or circumstance so that the anxiety is reduced by the avoidance, but the fear is reinforced in so doing. So we need to kind of ride anxiety out and not avoid. Now, what does spirituality have to contribute to all of this? Earlier, I talked about serenity, and we defined it as peace of mind or inner peace. We pray at Mass, grant us peace. And as I said at the beginning, that's more and more appealing as I age. Maybe you will find that too. Abraham Maslow talked about the need to bring calmness into our psychological state, that we need the serene as well as the poignantly emotional. Serenity involves accepting ourselves, trusting in God's will, and discerning when to take the appropriate action versus engaging in compulsive behaviors because we believe that we can't tolerate whatever the feeling is, whatever the anxiety or guilt may be about. Experiencing joy in our lives, not to be too focused on accomplishment and getting the thing, whatever it may be, over with, as much as staying in the present and enjoying the experience. How do we attain this kind of serenity? I talked about this in the last talk a bit on unrelenting standards. I'll reiterate by summary here. To highlight detachment in our lives, to detach from emotions, visceral sensations, and surrounding circumstances, to be less focused on attachment to our fear and more able to detach from these fears so that we can experience serenity, focusing in on our breathing and distinguishing our needs from our wants. This is a very important point. Oftentimes, we think we need all kinds of things in order to be happy. Wealth, success, perfection, reputation, establishment, connections, etc. And when we get right down to it, we may come to the spiritual realization that I may not have everything I want, but that God will provide my every need. And meditation can be very helpful for us to be in the presence of a God who supplies, who provides, who cares for me, just as he does for the birds and for nature and for all of creation. It's very important for us to identify a safe place. Often when I am working with people who are trauma survivors or who are dealing with anxiety, as I've been describing in this talk, they don't have any place where they feel safe. It's like no place to run to, no place to hide. And so I try to encourage people to come up with an image of a safe place. It could be a real image, a place that you have been, or one imaginary place, a song, a taste, a smell, to really engage that moment so that when anxiety starts to build, ascend in the way we described, you can punctuate that ascension with a moment of being in the safe place, of just allowing your senses to engage that safe place. Use Matthew 6, verses 25 to 34, when Jesus talks about the lilies of the field. This is really a tonic scripture passage for anyone suffering from anxiety, because Jesus emphasizes the need to let go and let God. To let God take control of circumstances that are beyond my control, and especially of my own inner enemies of perfectionism and shame that's often accompanied by this perfectionism. To let God love me as God will love me, and to repair me as God wishes to do it in God's own time. Spiritually, the challenge is to live fully in the present, to receive time as a gift, to trust in the benevolent wisdom of God, what we otherwise call providence. This relaxes our defenses and helps me to acknowledge that my true needs are provided for by God without a struggle. We can cultivate openness to change. Often anxiety is driven by the need to hold on to the familiar. I had a psychiatrist supervisor once who said, "You know, bad breath is better than no breath at all." And we frequently hold on to bad situations because we're afraid of letting go, that we might not be able to breathe, as it were. In Isaiah 43:1-7, we are told to accept that each of us is a work in progress, that we are allowing God to be in control. Openness probably predisposes certain types to religious experience, to transcendence, but I believe it can be fostered even in the most anxious, neurotic among us. Seeking God in new places, in plays, in novels, in music. Above all, to be open to being surprised by God. To foster integrity, we need to reduce the secret compartments in my life as a way to counter anxiety. In 12-step programs, they have a slogan, "You're as sick as your secrets." That's so helpful for us on this path of dealing with anxiety. Anxiety, because it is shaming, often does motivate us to hold on to secrets about ourselves, our thoughts, our impulses, our fears. And so by trusting in a confidant, a spiritual director, a friend, by going to confession appropriately, sharing with God through the instrument of a priest what the fears are, what the anxiety is about, can dispel the demon, can take the sting out of the anxiety and help us to live more serene lives. To be comfortable with our ordinariness, to be content to be as we are instead of being driven by desires and fears. Robert Wicks in 1992 wrote in his book Touching the Holy that nowhere in the Bible is there a single instance of Christ clinging to his divinity. He wrote, quote, "He, Jesus, was not as obsessed with his image as we so often are with ours," unquote. Our spiritual connection to God can motivate us to live more peacefully the prayer of Jesus, "I come that you may have life and have it abundantly."